welcome once again to Steve's Speech Shop, in association, as ever, with our good friends at Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. This time on Speech Shop, we'll be asking the question, which was the greatest European executive express of the late 80s and early 90s, that time when executive cars became driver's cars? Was it the Mercedes W123 series? Was it the great-looking BMW 5 Series E28? Or was it the very lovely but not so quite well nailed together Jaguar XJ6? And we'll be finding out about an amazing discovery of the world's most valuable and collectible motorcycles, Brough Superiors no less, that has just come to light. But first, this.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
If George Barris had only ever built the Batmobile, and don't ask which Batmobile, it's like Star Trek, there's only one, the original one, then he'd be assured of his place in the Automotive Hall of Fame. But in his life and career as a designer and builder of cars, he did so much more. George Barris, born George Salapatas, on November the 20th, 1925. We know him better as George Barris. Let's talk to Mike Renault now, who is a motoring journalist, aren't you, Mike?
I'd like to think so, Steve, yes.
Well, I'll ask you a question, Mr. Mike Renault. It was George Barris, the father, the godfather of customising. Did he invent customising?
You started off with already with a difficult question, I think, without intending to. But
well, he claimed he had. Mike, if you look at all the sort of film footage, he'll say, you know, I was given as a 12-year-old boy a 1925 Buick that belonged to a family member that various people, no one's quite sure where it came from. But he was given a 1925 Buick, and he famously took the handles off his mother's chest of drawers and attached them to the grille of this Buick in an attempt to modify its appearance, him and his brother Sam. And he said, that's it. That's the beginning of customising cars, altering the appearance of standard stock showroom cars.
Yes and no. I mean, I wouldn't say he's the first. I think it's impossible to say who was the first who customised cars, but I would certainly say he was the most prolific, and he probably did the most for customising for several reasons, really. I mean, one, he was a very talented man. Himself and his brother Sam, they did an awful lot, and they pioneered some techniques. But he was also an incredibly good self-promoter. He was very, very good at showing everybody what he'd done and finding a million ways of getting his name out there. So while I wouldn't say he was the first, he was certainly one of the best, I'd say, at car customising.
Of course, Mike, it never would have happened if there wasn't a terrible tragedy in his early life. His mother died when he was just 3 years old, and that's why his father sent him out to live with him and his brother out to live from Chicago, where they were from, out to California. It never would have happened for those two in Chicago, would it? It was the wrong place. It was the right time, but the wrong place, Chicago, wasn't it?
That's absolutely it, yeah. I mean, they moved out to, I think it was Sacramento. They had a restaurant and a hotel. And that was really where they had the sunshine. They had the cars that were still affordable and cheap. They had the space to do what they wanted, and they were able to explore their interest in metalwork and in woodwork, and to meet some people who set them on their way for customizing cars. I mean, certainly that Buick was, that you mentioned, 1925 Buick sedan. They first repaired it, and then they bolted on a lot of accessories, painted it orange, and put rainbow stripes all over it. And now, a lot of people thought they were mad, but they managed to sell it at a profit and buy a 1929 Ford Model A. So that's a car that's already 4 years newer. So at that stage, they were still, I think, around 13, 14. And people were probably starting to set up and take notice and say, hang on, you can make money and buy a newer car just for something you're doing at home in your front yard.
And here's the thing that would surprise most people, Mike, including me. This was pre-war. I mean, very few people, even proper petrol heads, would imagine that customising began before the war. But it did, clearly, with George and Sam Barris.
Yes, it did. I've seen photos of 1918, 1920 Model Ts that are lowered and hot-rodded for speed and performance and for looks. And this is 1920s, very early 20s. So I think it pretty much happened from the time they built a car. Somebody, I mean, there's that famous saying that, you know, when the second car was built, someone said, great, we can have a race. That's, I really think, was what was happening. The cars weren't hugely fast, so everyone started to try and make them quicker.
He opened a shop, 18 years old, Barris Custom Shop on Imperial Highway in Bell, California. But I think one of the most important meetings of the many that he had in his life, George Barris, was with Robert Peterson, who, of course, would become Peterson's magazine's Hot Rod and Motor Trend magazine, would name drop George Barris, George and Sam Barris at this time still, all the time, and kind of in the mind of the American petrol head public, these two guys became the fountain of all knowledge. They were the people who would do a how-to on how to chop a roof or how to channel or how to French stuff or how to louver, all these techniques, which, as you say, what were they self-taught or did they get some machine shop experience in California?
They, I mean, just briefly, encompassing two decades of their career into one sentence, but they were both very proficient in metalwork and woodwork at school. They built model planes and model cars out of tin. And then George was aged around 15, and he got a 1936 Ford convertible, and a chap called Harry Westergaard, who was hugely into customising cars and is a very, very well-known name. He actually taught George quite a lot and took him into under his wing and into a shop. Sam went off into the Merchant Marine and learned his trades out there, and George was turned down for Army and Navy.
Right.
So in 1943, he started his own shop. And that was when Sam came back in 45. That was when they really started their own shop. And also started a car club, which was Customs Car Club, which was spelled with a K. George always liked to spell custom and car with a K if he possibly could. It was one of his little tricks.
So many, as you say, Mike, so many firsts, so many great ideas. And as important as being able to do the work on the cars and create the cars, this incredibly savvy self-publicity machine, which right from the very start is pushing Barris forward as the name for hot rods and custom cars, with as you say, a K. Did he invent custom with a K, George Barris?
I think he did. Yes, he did. Yeah. If he didn't, then he certainly took it as his own very early on and established it. And as you say, his promotion, I mean, he was very interested in what they were doing. Sam would be off chopping roofs and changing fenders around and things, and George would be photographing it, which immediately, as you say, with Peterson Publishing, George was able to go to them and say, right, we've just turned this car into something absolutely crazy. It's twice the length it was. It's half the size. And I've got photos of us doing the whole thing. Mm. And the magazines had very rarely seen this before. Nobody was doing how-to features. So immediately there was George with the technical credit, with the photo credit, with his beaming face there holding a welding torch, with him spray painting. Everything's been done at the Barris Custom Shop.
Clever.
Come on down and we'll do the same for your car.
Very clever. Here's another clever thing. Obviously, he's there in Southern California. Hollywood's right on his doorstep, almost literally. Mm. And he's the guy who came up with the notion of... It's when cars had to crash into each other in films, obviously there was a huge great collision and these hulking great Yank tanks would slam into each other with enormous violence. He worked out that if you recreated the car, but with aluminium body panels, the crash would be much more spectacular because the car, as we know, would just crumple instantly that it hit the other car. Plus, much less of an impact on the other vehicle. And that, bizarrely, is how George Barris got into the movie business. I would have thought he just knew people because they dropped into his shop or he met them at parties. None of it. He was the guy that made it safer to crash a car on film. I think the first one was in North by Northwest when that car's harassing Cary Grant and slams into the back of him. That was a Barris creation.
That was a stunt that actually came about, not so much for safety as for money saving. You won't be surprised to hear. Yes, he recreated a three-car crash. The car in the middle had to get squashed. They were hired cars. They didn't actually own the car. So somebody had the sensible suggestion of, why don't we redo the front and the rears that are going to get hit, as you say, in thin aluminium. Barris then had to lower them a couple of inches at the front, the back, and both ends on the car in the middle. So they weren't sitting a lot higher than they would have with the less weight on. They then crashed the cars into each other, sped the film up slightly so it looked incredibly violent, then put the standard car parts back on, and they went back off to the rental place. No one was any the wiser.
Really? That really happened? Yep. What a great story. We haven't really got time to talk about all the vehicles that came out of the Barris workshop and ended up on television or in film. So let's stick to the two most famous, Mike. Firstly, the Munster coach.
Yes.
Come on! One of the coolest cars ever built and made, wasn't it, out of three Model Ts?
Yes, it was three Model T bodies. It ended up, I think it was 23 feet long. Barris was always had things knocking around that he could turn into cars. The Munsters, obviously, was the TV show with the house full of monsters, the Munster family. And Barris was told, can you make a car for us? So he built this Munsters coach using a Ford Mustang engine that he got from Ford. Very well known amongst the various different car companies, and he could pretty much say, I want these, I want this wheels, I want these tyres, and they could turn them up. So, he built that. I'm not sure how long it took him, but generally, he did things pretty quickly.
Did he have to make special account of the fact that Fred Gwynne was like 6'8" or something like that? The actor who played Herman Munster, who of course would drive. Was the Munster coach drivable? Because if there is a criticism of George Barris in the hot rod community, it's that unlike his main competitors, like sort of Dean Jeffries, Gene Wingfield, Big Daddy Roth, Ed Roth, of course, they say, oh, well, Barris's cars look great, but they weren't drivers. You couldn't drive them.
Oh, it very definitely it did drive. It wasn't driven very often, certainly on the freeways anyway, but no, it was driven in the episode where they raced the Dragula, which was the dragster based around the coffin.
Both cars were
drivable, and certainly Dragula did. Dragula was driven down the freeway at one point.
I'll never forget that episode where Herman turns up in all the sort of rocker gear. He's got like the leather jacket and he's got the leather cap with a chain across the front. And he turns round to show the family. And on the back of his jacket, it says Punk Rods. And there's a knife dripping blood on the back of his jacket, it'd be a good name for a band, wouldn't it? The Punk Rods. I can't believe that there hasn't been a band called that. But made out of three Model Ts, I'm not sure I would have wanted to pump the Munster coach along the freeway at any sort of speed, Mike.
1927 Ford, and I'm assured, I mean, a lot of it was fiberglass. The biggest problem with that car actually was the bored out Mustang engine. It was only a small block Ford, and if it had been over revved, I mean, somebody I think worked out that the walls of that engine were less than an eighth of an inch thick. They were very, very thin. It had been bored out so much.
Wow. The Batmobile.
The Batmobile, yes.
The Batmobile. Here's the thing, like, people will say, oh, well, which one? But in my mind, Mike, as a man of a certain age, there is only one Batmobile, the Barris Batmobile. That's it. That is the Batmobile. The others are something else.
The 1966 Batmobile, the one that probably everybody knows because it was on the TV show. Obviously, as you say, Batman had been going around since the 30s in various cars. But this was the one that everybody recognises and remembers.
Yeah, and why, Mike? Because as men of a certain age, whether in Europe or the States or wherever you were, we had the toy Batmobile. Was it a Corgi? It was a Corgi, yeah. Wasn't it? And it had an ejector seat and it fired red rockets, yeah?
It fired rockets. It had, I mean, this was, to sort of get a little bit of history to this, they were doing the TV show in 1966, and it was a kind of a very, very tongue-in-cheek kind of silly knockabout show, as you probably remember. And they wanted a fairly outlandish cartoon car. George Barris had a concept car that had been built by Ford in 1955, the Lincoln Futura. It was a one-off car he bought for $1.
A dollar?
Wow. Yeah, he bought it for $1. I mean, this was a probably $500,000 car when it was built. Ford had no further use for it. In 1959, it starred in a film, and then Barris bought it for $1, and it just sat off to one side until 1966, when they said, we need a Batmobile. And George obviously said, yeah, great, when do you need it? And they said 3 weeks. So he had to turn this car into the Batmobile within 3 weeks, and it was 24-hour sessions round the clock. Fortunately, if you ever see pictures of the Futura, you can see that a lot of the Batmobile is already there. It had the bubble canopies, it had angled front and rear fins. What he really did was cut open the wheel arches, put bigger wheels on, a lot of paint, and added an awful lot of little trick gadgets, which were, as you say, things like the rocket firing, the slasher thing at the front, that like a big blade that opened in the front bumper, and various little toys. Probably one of the best was the rocket at the back, which was some sort of turbine, basically, with a load of flame coming out the back, that was actually a dustbin. Rolled a dustbin in the back and just filled it full of petrol and set light to it.
How many Batmobiles were there, Mike? Do we know? Or was it...
There was one original, which was the proper Batmobile. This was the one that George almost got arrested for setting off the parachutes on the freeway, and the police pulled him over and couldn't work out if he was breaking the law or not. He then built a further four, which were made out of fiberglass and were built, I think, on Lincoln Continental chassis. One of them may have been on the Mercury. But they were made out of fiberglass. They looked almost identical. And then, you know, the genuine car was then saved for promotional purposes, and the others went off to do shows and to do stunts and things like that.
And here's the thing, which would never happen today, Mike, never, ever happen again. George retained the car and retained the rights to the car, which is incredible, isn't it? I mean, there's absolutely no way today that the makers of a movie or a TV series, they'd be on that before they even started filming, wouldn't they? There's no way they'd say, oh, do you want to keep the car? Because, of course, he sold it for quite a lot of money, didn't he, George?
He did. It was a simpler time, I think. And they probably felt, I mean, if he managed to turn the car around in 3 weeks, which was by no means unusual, they either thought, hey, you know, let's give this guy a break. This show's not going to run forever. No one's going to remember it in 1968. Or perhaps George very, very cleverly wrote something into the contract that they didn't see. Who knows? I think either way is quite possible. George was certainly no fool. He was a talented man, and he didn't give things away for free.
Well,
he was a very, very nice chap, for all accounts. He was a very nice guy to deal with.
Well, yeah.
Very honest.
And alongside all the cars for movies and television, he's cultivated the Hollywood crowd and made a lot of money. George Barris, or the Barris Shop, turned out customised cars for Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Anne Margaret, Glen Campbell, Elton John, the Beach Boys, Elvis, Sonny and Cher. What a clever guy.
Clint Eastwood. Yeah. Sammy Davis Jr. One of the most interesting ones that he did, and he did four or five for John Wayne.
Really?
John Wayne being very, very tall. John had a long body, but normal kind of length legs. And he liked to drive around in anonymity. So every year he took a Pontiac station wagon over to George, and George raised the roof by 6 inches so the Duke could drive around with enough headroom but not look very, very obvious in a customised car. Some of those cars still exist.
Yeah, the equivalent of kind of like those shoes that have a lift inside, that it's rumoured that certain of... I was just going to say it under my breath, but I shouldn't, because...
Maybe an analogy, you don't want to go down there, Steve.
They've got way, way more money than me and much, 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 much better lawyers. My lawyer's pretty good, but he's not as good as this. What about this controversy late on in his career and his life with the Back to the Future car, with the DeLorean, which, of course, has been much in the news? What with it being, you know, what with it being the date that they went Back to the Future just a couple of weeks ago? Did he get in trouble because he said that he built it and he didn't? Is that essentially it?
I don't know for sure on that one, so I wouldn't like to say either way. I've certainly heard rumours that, along the lines, certain cars George said or felt that he designed, it transpired he didn't. And there have been rumours along those lines with the DeLoreans. He's laid claim to the Dukes of Hazzard. He's said he did the Pink Panther car at one point, which, ooh, again, I don't believe is the case. The Monkey Mobile, he apparently had a hand in, but again, wasn't entirely his. And he did have a tendency to buy back other cars. So the Black Beauty from the Green Hornet, the original Black Beauty cars, I know at one point he bought those. I'm not aware that he designed them, but he recustomized them and put them back on the show circuit as George Barris Green Hornet cars. It's with some fairly awful 1970s modifications. Mm. So it's certainly not impossible that George may have misremembered certain things over the years.
Oh, we've all done that. Mike, did Detroit ever come knocking for George? Why didn't they get this incredibly clever, amazingly creative guy in to give their cars a bit of a kick up the backside?
Well, supposedly they did work reasonably close together on certain cars. Now, I don't know if you can picture the 1958 Chevrolet Impala.
I can.
But everything on that car was a customising touch. It had the fake scoops down the side. It had bullet tail lights. It had the twin headlights. It had wraparound chrome bumpers. Everything on that, it was lower. It was longer. It was a factory custom car. And it's the same with the 63 Buick Riviera. That was a factory custom car, solely designed around what was being done by George Barris and others.
Oh, the 63 Riv. Oh, what a car.
Gorgeous, I know. Oh. So, to an extent, they were copying what George was doing. And obviously, Detroit had a year or two's lead time to work out all their tooling and everything. But they were copying each other. Obviously, George and the others were customising what Detroit had, and Detroit was customising.
Mike, what's your favourite? Out of all the cars that George Barris had a hand in, and there were many, as you've just reminded us, which was your favourite? It's okay, you can go for the obvious one. That's the one I'm going to go for.
I'm unfortunately going to go for one that probably no one will be able to picture. Huh. But it's one of the very early customised lead sleds that George and Sam worked on when they were first starting out. It's a 1949 Mercury that had the top lowered right down. It's one of the first cars they ever customised. And they basically showed, Sam certainly showed the world how to chop, a roof chop, a Mercury. And everyone since then has copied it. So it would be one of those, a dark green 49 Mercury that I believe is still around and has been restored.
Well, Mike, I'm sure that it's a very nice car, but it ain't the Batmobile. Thanks, Mike.
No problem at all, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Across the world, 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to Steve's Speed Shop. Now, we've all heard those stories, haven't we? That chap with a farm who's got a couple of old Bugattis stashed in his barn. That guy with a rare old Bentley bricked up in a cellar somewhere in the city. And, of course, most of them are just that. They're just tales. They're just stories. Ben Walker from Bonhams, the auctioneer, had heard the story, as many of us had, of a collection of Brough Superior motorcycles that were rotting away in a leaky old shed somewhere in England's West Country. So he decided to send somebody down there to knock on doors
and ask questions. And what that guy found is incredible.
So, Ben, tell me the story. How did these bikes come to light after so long in the dark?
Well, we had a tip-off about the existence of a collection of bikes in some very dilapidated sheds in Bodmin, in Cornwall. And there was always an urban myth or rumour that there were the existence of these amazing bikes. But it was only really known to a very select few that they really did exist.
Yeah, but Ben, we've all heard these stories a million times. Oh, I know this guy who's got a few Bugattis tucked away in a barn up in the hills. Or there's some bloke who's got some pre-war Indians or Indian Fours or something like that. Or there's an old...
Yeah, and always the TT winner as well, Steve. Always a TT winner.
If it's a Harley, if it's an American motorcycle, it always belonged to James Dean or Elvis.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, sometimes it is true. And, you know, blow me, it was true with regards to these Brough Superiors, because that's what they were. They were Brough Superiors, and there were 8 of them in the sheds. And we didn't have an address. And I must admit, I really am not a fan of cold calling. But
were you just sat in your office in London one day and you thought, damn it, was it like that? Did you just think, damn it, I'm going to find out if these Broughs actually exist once and for all? Was it like that?
Well, a little bit like that. It was a collaboration between myself and my colleague, Jonathan Vickers, who runs our West Country offices. And we were sat there on the phone and we went on to Google Maps. We knew the location. We knew the village. And we looked for the most likely looking property and then went and knocked on the door.
Literally went and knocked on the door.
Literally. My colleague John went and knocked on the door. Unfortunately, there was no one there, but the neighbour did question what Jonathan was up to. Quite right that she did too. And John explained and said, well, we think there is a collection of motorcycles in these sheds and this is me and this is my business card. And she said, well, there is a collection and I'll pass your details on to the family who are now looking after the gentleman. And she did. And one of the family members phoned John and said, yes, there are some bikes and requested our assistance. And it went from there. We got access to the sheds where the bikes were. And inside was an Aladdin's cave. It was like nothing we've ever seen before. Probably not likely to see again.
Oh, come
well,
on, Ben.
I say that.
You've seen it all, mate. I know that
I'm
you
talking
have...
rubbish, aren't I?
You,
yeah.
But you have seen it all, but you're honestly saying that this is your day-to-day business, tracking down rare, collectible, historic motorcycles, but even you are saying that this was a very special thing indeed.
It was astonishing. It was astonishing. And like I say, chances are I will see something like this again, because nothing is unique in this world. And sooner or later, it's all cyclical. Things get put away, they eventually come back out. Unfortunately, it is usually when someone passes away that these things are discovered. But this was something really, really special. Spine-tingling, so exciting. When have you ever seen a Brough Superior SS100 buried in the dirt? The mind boggles. The fact that it's such a rare bike and such a prestigious machine, the Rolls-Royce of motorcycles.
Yes, as it was dubbed by the motorcyclist, the Rolls-Royce. And Rolls-Royce, of course, could have objected and could have made them stop them from using it. But didn't they famously, didn't Rolls-Royce, Ben, this is the story, another old wives' tale maybe, didn't they famously ask for a Brough Superior motorcycle to examine and then said, no, you're all right, you can say it's the Rolls-Royce of motorcycling?
That's my understanding. And I think it was also applied to a lawnmower manufacturer as well, the Rolls-Royce of lawnmower manufacturer. Sorry about that. Yeah, don't quote me on that one. But I'm not a Rolls-Royce expert. I have friends who I will find out what the story with regards to the lawnmowers is. But yeah, that's my understanding. But the fact that the Rolls-Royce of motorcycles, one of the Rolls-Royce, in fact, not all am I saying, 1/8 of these bikes were in there. And sadly, in a very, very poor condition.
How would the collection come together? This gentleman had been a brough. I mean, in the current market, would it be fair? There are very few motorcycles that could ever come to market. I'm thinking of super rare bikes, one-offs, things. Maybe the Guzzi V8. Maybe there are some early American motorcycles that may possibly fetch the same. I'm trying to think of anything that was fetch as much as a Brough Superior. And to find so many of them, how would this gentleman acquire the collection? Because, as you know only too well, but maybe people wouldn't be aware, there was a time when people didn't want these bikes. They were just old bits of nonsense that nobody really wanted. Is that when he acquired them?
That's my understanding. We're still in the process of researching and trying to establish the firm history and provenance on these bikes. But I understand that the gentleman's stepdad was an engineer of some description, and he travelled the country. And when he did, he would ask if there were any old motorcycles or if there were any old Brough Superiors.
Mm.
And he was able to purchase them, bring them back for his son, and give them to him as presents. And that's how they were acquired. It's like all these things, Steve, you know, it just takes a little bit of time sometimes to piece together the exact sort of story and what the exact scenario was. But it was during the 1950s and 60s when they were just old motorcycles. There wasn't the interest, the passion, the enthusiasm. Well, there was interest. I mean, obviously, his father recognised the fact that they were interesting machines. They were, he knew, he had the hindsight, if you like, to know that these were something special, but were now, you know, 20, 30 years old and very affordable.
Well, when the Triumph Bonnevilles and the Norton Commandos and the BSA Gold Stars were burning up the Queen's Highway, nobody wanted Vincents and Broughs. I met a guy who was using, or had around that time, was using a Vincent to pull a sidecar which had a lathe in it, which he used to cut keys and sharpen knives and stuff like that. Can you imagine a Vincent being used? I know of a Brough, I swear to God, Ben, I know of a Brough that was used for many years, for decades, to deliver coal. There was a great big sidecar on it. People just looked at these big old V-twin motorcycles, Broughs and Vincents and Matchless and other British manufacturers, and thought, yeah, there's a big old bus that I could use to... They didn't look at them the way we do now, which is, these are the most collect... Ben, I'll ask you straight. Are Brough Superiors the most collectible, the most historic, and the most expensive motorcycles out there right now?
They are... I should be a politician, Steve. Never good at answering a direct question. They are one of the most desirable, one of the most expensive, and one of the most collectible motorcycles out there. I don't want to upset or offend anybody, so...
I do it every week.
they are, if you were to look at the top 20 bikes sold worldwide, as far as I'm aware, Brough is the most prominent.
Yeah.
So that would suggest that, yes, they are not as yet, the most expensive bike sold publicly is not a Brough Superior. But I suspect that's just going to be a matter of time.
Oh, what's the holy grail? What's the holy grail, Ben, when it comes to Broughs?
Well, the holy grail when it comes to Broughs is, aside from, because we have got a four-cylinder Brough Superior in amongst the collection that we got out of the Bodmin garages, but a real holy grail would be one of Lawrence's bikes.
Yeah. And he had did he have seven and one on order when he met his early demise? Was that the...
That's correct. Yeah, he had it was a two of everything that was on order, which of course he never did delivery of. And I don't know that that bike has ever been firmly identified. Again, I'm sure the guys in the Brough Superior Owners Club will be able to confirm or deny.
Why is this, Ben? Why are they? I mean, there are much more famous names. In that top 20 list, you're saying Brough is the most prominent name. But there'll be names that everyone's heard of. There'll be Harley Davidson. There'll be Indian. Then, as I say, there might be Moto Guzzi if the V8 ever came up for sale. These are bike names that still exist today. They're still making bikes. Brough Superior made bikes for 20 years. They made 3,000 bikes. I know that Mark Upham's doing great work to revive the Brough name with a new bike, but it's still very niche. It's very sort of very, very low numbers. Why are Brough Superiors so valuable, so collectible?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. They were niche in their day. They were low volume production. We're also talking about a man who was a very aggressive marketer and exceptional at promoting his products. Racing is important. It was a Brough Superior that became the first side valve engine machine to lap Brooklands at over 100 miles an hour. And of course, as we've touched on already, they were the transport of choice for the likes of Lawrence and other, you know, sporting gentlemen of the era.
Well, at the time, they were more than a year's wages to buy, weren't they? They were like £200 at a time when the average wage in Britain was £150 a year. They were the playthings of men of wealth,
of the rich and famous. Yep, and Brough guaranteed a top speed on them.
And
he had a guaranteed 80 miles an hour. I'm brilliant. Unheard of.
And they're still incredible motorcycles to ride. One of the greatest days of my motorcycling career was going out with one of the best-known restorers of Broughs in the country. And the strangest thing was I went to his workshop, which I think this is common knowledge in the Brough world, but it's at a sort of oversized shed at the bottom of his garden, which he's not really supposed to operate out of because I think it's not zoned for any sort of industrial use. So you have to go through his house, and his wife was there making a meal, and there were cats, and I had to step over a tricycle and stuff, and then down to the bottom of the garden, literally led to the bottom of the garden where there was this incredible, you've already said it, but I'll say it, Aladdin's cave of Brough Superiors and engines and frames and parts and all of the things that will be needed to restore this bike. And we ended up going out for the day, and I was warned about how valuable the bike was and how we had to be very careful. And about quarter of an hour later, and I'll say it out loud, we were exceeding the speed limit on the highway. We were both flying along on motorcycles that are the thick end of a century old and passing everything on the road. I mean, they are still phenomenal motorcycles to ride.
Yep. There are some fantastic YouTube videos out there as well of various Brough owners demonstrating the capabilities of their motorcycles.
And would you
say, worth watching.
Would you say, so two questions just to finish, Ben. I saw that you told me about them. We met at the Triumph, the launch of the new Triumph Bonneville. You told me about these bikes. I saw two of them at the Alexandra Palace show the next day. And of course, the thing that most people notice is, yes, it's all there. Yes, they're complete motorcycles, but the condition is amongst the worst I have ever seen. Are you telling me it will be possible to properly restore these motorcycles? Are the parts available? Will things have to be made from scratch?
There are going to be items that will be need to be made from scratch, but they are extremely restorable. I think approximate cost of restoration using a well-known Brough Superior restorer, I'm guessing somewhere between £30,000 and £40,000 is achievable. And when you think about the economics of it, the SS100, which was a machine, one of the machines that you saw on display at the Alexandra Palace show, that is estimated at £60,000 to £80,000.
Ben, it looked like it had been up at the bottom of the English Channel for half a century. I mean, it's all there. It's all there. And that's the important thing, isn't it?
Well, it is all there, and it's matching numbers. You see, I got a couple of, if I was in the fortunate position of being able to buy that motorcycle, if you were the Brough Superior collector with everything, that bike could be possibly stabilised so it didn't deteriorate any further, and you could keep it just as it is as a workout.
That would be fascinating to keep
would
it.
Would be
good. But I strongly suspect that that's not going to be the case.
Or the value of it restored, bearing in mind it is matching frame and engine, value of that bike restored is going to be somewhere between £180,000 and £220,000.
Wow.
Okay. We've got an estimate of 60 to 80,000. Cost of restoration, if you're going to do it yourself, it will obviously be cheaper, but let's say you use a professional. Broadly, let's say broadly speaking, 40 to 60,000 pounds for restoration. You've got an outlay of 120 to 140,000 pounds. And you're going to have a bike that's going to be worth 180 to 220,000.
You're a good salesman, Ben. I spent many, many happy minutes. In fact, longer than I should have, more like an hour, just staring at these bikes and just letting my imagination run riot, imagining the life that they must have had since they left George Brough's Nottingham factory. Years ago. But I think I know why. But could you tell people, why on earth aren't the bikes being restored before they're offered for sale?
Well, it's not something that we would do. And it's not something that the owners of the bikes want to do either. And besides anything else, there's something very visceral about these bikes. And again, you spent too long looking at them at the show, Steve. It's the possibilities. You know, you have the option to restore this bike to your own specification and standard. And chances like this so rarely come along. It's an affordable option for someone because, let's face it, the majority of people, myself included, don't have the opportunity. You know why I include myself? Because, of course, some darned auctioneer keeps on selling for more and more money. It's a problem because they do get pushed out of the reach of people myself.
We're talking here about motorcycles that are worth, we're talking the thick end of £250,000. Either of us have imagined when a collectible motorcycle, even a Brough, would have reached that figure? But compared to a car of equivalent historical significance and collectability, it's a fraction of what something on four wheels with the same sort of story and the same sort of, from the same sort of mark with so much prestige with it. It's a fraction of the cost, really, isn't it, Ben?
I still think that bikes, even at the levels that we're talking about, still represent very good value for money when you compare them to the motor car equivalents. Sounds like a crazy thing to say, but I firmly believe that. And coming back to these bikes, they are an affordable option.
You keep saying that, but we're still talking about very large. Right, so Ben, when are the bikes? The bikes are on a bit of a tour at the moment before they're offered up for sale. When will they actually go under the hammer?
They are going to be sold on the 24th of April, 2016, at the Classic Motorcycle Mechanic Show at Stafford.
No better place for it. And where do you imagine they'll end up, Ben? Will they go to the States, or will they go out to China or Russia, or will they stay in the UK?
I think they're going to go all over the world. Right. I think that the bikes they'll go all over the world. I have no idea. This is the other exciting aspect of my job, is I never know where I'm going to get a phone call from.
Right. You think that this isn't the last time this is going to happen? You're convinced that there are still stashes of cars and bikes shoved in sheds, old garages, barns, locked away in castles, and the phone could ring as soon as I put the phone down. It could ring again, and you could be off again on another adventure.
Yep, 100%.
That's great. Okay, thanks, Ben. Brilliant interview. Thank you, pal. Always a delight to talk to you.
No worries, Steve. Pleasure.
Thanks, pal. Bye bye.
Embrace the alternative.
Welcome back to Steve's Speed Shop in association with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. Time now for the greatest.
So it's time for that part of the show, which I always enjoy, if nobody else does. The greatest. We start with our long list of 99 cars. We take them three at a time in an attempt to discover which one is the greatest car of all time. I'm always joined by two guests, and this week it's Guy Loveridge, the chairman of the Guild of Motoring Writers, and Ian Kellett from IK Classics, the carding shed. Ian, how should we describe you? Racer, restorer, entrepreneur?
All of those and more. This is not just a garage, it's more than that. So what can we say?
It's kind of the North of England version of the...
Don't say it.
The Rock Store. Ah, you see. Ah, you thought I was going to say the Ace Cafe, didn't you, in London? No, I was saying the Rock Store, just above Los Angeles. It's a destination for petrol heads of all varieties up here in the north of England. And a very popular spot it is too. The three cars that we're here to discuss this week are... Well, I'll tell you what, Guy, you tell us what the category is, because you came up with it. It's your fault.
It's all my fault. The catch-all title has to be late 70s bank manager's favourites.
Yeah, so the three cars are the Mercedes W123 series, probably the 280e would be the car that we would be thinking of, the BMW E28, a personal favourite of mine. I've had three of them, and again, we should probably be thinking about the equivalent car, so maybe the 525, and I don't know whether it's in the right company here, but the equivalent Jaguar XJ6. Guy, tell us why the Jag, which a lot of people would think was a cut above, is in this kind of company. Contrary to what people think, there wouldn't have been that much difference in price with one of the top-range German cars and the Jag, would there?
Absolutely not. A Series 2 XJ6 with the 4.2 engine is absolutely in the right monetary category here and was the aspirational car in this company. That's why I've constructed it thus, because your bank manager, when he was a clerk, his manager had an S-Type or a Mark II Jaguar. That's what he aspired to. And by the time he got up, 76, 77, to managerial level at the bank, what's he going to buy? He's going to buy a Jag.
I think for the first time in the history of this feature, I've owned all three cars. So I've driven at least a couple of them and have some experience of the other. But on this occasion, I have owned all three. And I think it says something about me, Ian, doesn't it? It says I've always been a bit of an old man. They're kind of old man's cars, aren't they?
Well, I would have said so with the Mercedes and the Jaguar, but with the BMW, that was the sportsman's car. That was the driver's car, the racer's car. So, I'll give you the BMW, but an old man with the Jag and the Merc, definitely.
I think, were we calling it the 5 Series? The E12 was the original 5 Series, wasn't it, Ian?
Yeah, but the E28, that carried on as being a 5 Series. So, yeah, 525, but I would have gone 528.
The 528, I've had a 525, I had a 528E, which is the one that had a carburetor rather than fuel injection, wasn't it?
No, the 528E was the ETA version, which was the smaller engine, which was bored out. Yes, it was.
No, it's because he's from Lancashire. It's the 528E.
That's a bit rich, being in Huddersfield, and you two are going to go at me for my accent, but not for my choice of car. I think the best one of the three, though, was I had a 520i Lux, and that was a fantastic-looking car with alloy wheels, silver paintwork, the quad headlights, so distinctive, that shark nose styling. Great-looking car from any angle. And inside, because it was the Lux, a radio cassette with an electric aerial, electric windows, velour seats. For its time, an advanced car, a great driver's car, a great-looking car, and a well-equipped car.
Definitely. They were difficult with the specification that you could get from BMW. Well, we used to get customers, because I worked at a BMW garage, we used to get customers that would have the badges removed, and then nobody knew what they were. You could spec them up, so you could have the ultimate, which was the 535. You could make your little 518 look like a 535.
Well, my solicitor, when I bought my first house as a young man, quite a bit younger than most people at the time, again, I think I have always been a bit of an old man. There's quite a lot of evidence for that here, isn't it? I'm 20 years old and I'm buying my first house, and my solicitor, who was twice my age, had a 518 debadged, an E28 518, and he was mourning bitterly about the lack of go in this car. But the 520 was a much better car than the 518, wasn't it, Ian?
I would beg to differ there. The 518, if you got it wound up, was quicker than the slower 520. The 520 was a bit of a sluggish engine. So four-cylinder used to rev quite well. The six-cylinder was a bit slow. And the 518 was a little bit quicker if you knew how to drive it.
And here's the thing, a great-looking car, I think, Guy. And particularly in that incarnation, the 520 Hilux, Great looking alloy wheels. Still echoes of BMWs from the 60s, from the O2 series, which is the model that made BMW what they are today. I had three of those incredible cars, now being valued for what they are, and the price is going through the roof of nice BMW O2s. And for me, that one, much better looking than the 535i, which looks terribly dated now, doesn't it?
It hasn't aged well. I mean, on this point, I have to acknowledge both of you that the Jaguar looked an old man's car and remained an old man's car. It didn't look fantastic.
Joking? We're talking the XJ40 at this point, yeah.
No, pre-XJ40.
Series 3. Series 2.
J6, yeah.
Yeah. Hold on, because that's why I got confused, because I thought we were talking about the Series 3 XJ6, and then you were talking about it's not a great looking car. It's a fabulous looking car. It's an awesome looking car. I mean, the XJ40 is the one that came after it, yep. And was a much better car dynamically, but a lot of people are unhappy with its kind of...
That's because it had,
angular looks.
It had an awful lot of Honda in it. I mean, the base model was the 2.9 Honda 6 out of the Prelude, which my dad had as a company car. I remember going to Le Mans for my first Le Mans in that, and him trying to keep up with a double six and a sovereign, and it just wasn't going to happen.
But how long had the XJ6 been around by this time? Was it really starting to show its age?
1968, the first 2.8 XJ6 came out. So by the Series 2, that had been stretched as far as it could. And the Series 3 iteration is a gorgeous, gorgeous car. But that's why the XJ40 happened, because there was nowhere left for them to go by the mid-80s. It had to either change radically or they'd be accused of standing still again, which is why the E-Type disappeared.
Well, I think the XJ40 is a very good car. I don't think it's a great car by any stretch. And I think of as the value of all old cars seems to be going nuts at the moment, a good XJ40, the 3.2 or the 4-litre, is a good buy right now. It's a good buy. But we're not talking about the XJ40. No. We're talking about the Series 3. And in some ways, I'm delaying talking to Ian because I don't think he's going to have very good things to say about it. He's looking quizzical.
All I can say about Jaguar is British Leyland. End of. Good car. It was a good car in its time. But unfortunately, the people that built it had a different agenda and weren't really looking to make the best car that there was in that bracket. They were just looking to make their packets fuller and work less. So the car suffered.
How many cars can we say that about? I was talking to somebody the other day about my Alfa Romeo GTV6 and saying, from a design point of view and the constituent parts that went into it, yes, perhaps considered... perhaps worthy of greatness, but unfortunately, due to the situation that Alfa Romeo find themselves in at that time, I think you have the Series 3 XJ6, like that Alfa, is one of those cars that people who've owned it feel differently about, because the experience of owning it is rarely one that's without quite a considerable amount of pain and heartache. Would you agree, Guy?
I can only agree utterly. It's my first XJ6, came into a mate's garage, Merlin Motors as it then was in Almondbury here in Huddersfield, and it had blacked out windows and a base bin in the boot, and it was going and the chap had to leave Huddersfield.
Hold on, was this before you bought it or after you bought it?
This was before I bought it, and the guy had to leave Huddersfield very rapidly and had bought it in for and I gave him, I'm pretty sure, £300 for it.
Did you keep it all gangster for a while just for a laugh, or did you?
Yes. I did for a bit, and then I couldn't
skulking
cope with it.
Skulking around Huddersfield with Radio 4 blasting out of the...
Literally smoking round. It was just after I graduated, and it got to the point where I was running it on engine flush because it was burning so much oil, it was like a destroyer laying smoke. I remember coming off the motorway at Junction 38, and as I lifted off, it started to clatter like a couple of skeletons having a fight in a biscuit tin. And I pulled into the lay-by by a bus.
It's all right, Guy. You can say like a couple of skeletons having sex. You can say that.
Whatever. And I opened the bonnet, and I remember pouring engine flush in and setting myself on fire because it dribbled onto the red-hot exhaust. But it didn't destroy it.
Ian will know about this. Ian, is that Jag, that Series 3 XJ6, is it one of those cars that the ills of which have been cured down the years? There are certain cars, aren't there, that are not right when they're new, but
owners over the decades that pass, owners, once they reach classic status, manage to sort all those things out. And in a way, a lot of Italian cars are like this, aren't they? In a way, make it the car that the manufacturer always wanted to be. Is it possible now to find a Series 3 XJ6 with all the ills sorted?
Oh, definitely. Yes, you can do. Yeah. But it takes an awful lot of effort. You know, when you find the nut in the sill that's all sealed unit and somebody's put a nut in there with a little note that says, see if you can find this rattle. You know, it's things like that.
Ian, that's just a rumour. That's just one of those stories that people tell. Hold on a second. It's one of those stories that people tell about British Leyland. It has no foundation in facts, that the workers, who were sort of one step away from Stalinists, used to put sort of messages in the car saying, ha-ha, bet you wish you'd never bought this now, don't you? In parts of the car that they knew would fail, just to kind of taunt the people that had bought the car. These are all wives' tales. You've never actually found one of those notes.
No, but I did find something in a BMW. I've got to admit, I did find a little bit of a cheeky note in a BMW.
And was it in German?
No, because it was an English market car, and they'd written it in English, bad English, and I can't say what it was on the radio.
All I'm saying is two World Wars and one World Cup.
Yeah, that's all I've got. The three-digit reference, all of them. But I have a friend who genuinely went and did his apprenticeship at Jaguars, and he was given a Daimler 66 of this vintage.
So let's just emphasise the vintage. We're talking early 80s, yeah. Late 70s, early
79 80s. 79 car. He was given it to check, and they said, look, it's been at the dealers, it won't run right. He took it out, ran it, couldn't make it run right, couldn't work it out. So he took it back to the workshop, you know, put it on. Still very powerful, still very quick, but it just wasn't running smoothly. And they said, look, you know, if you can fix it, you know, sort it, you can drive it while you're here. And he took a particular interest, and he came back after a week, and he said, I've worked it out. I said, what is that then? He said, it's a V11. And it genuinely, from new, only had 11 pistons and rods attached to the engine. They hadn't put 12 cylinders on the car from new.
Let's tell that story again, because it's a great story. We should have it without interruption. So, come on, guy. You've got a story that you believe.
I know this to be true.
You know it to be true.
I do. A very good friend of mine who was running a car manufacturing business on the Isle of Wight, his son went to do his apprenticeship at Jaguar, and he was given a problem to solve, a real-world problem. This car's been in and out of managed and three times. The owner's thrown it back, spat his dummy out. It will not run smoothly. It's a V12, Sovereign. He drove it, said, well, it's still powerful. I said, yeah, but look at fuel consumption and look at, it's just not right. It doesn't feel right. And he looked at it, he said, yeah, you're right, absolutely. And, okay, I'll take it away and it'll be my pet project. So if you sort it, you can drive it while you're an apprentice here. And he spent a week on it, lunchtimes, whenever he had a break. And he came back and he said, I've solved the problem. They said, what's that? He said, it's a V11. What do you mean? He said, there's only 11 conrods and pistons in this engine. When it was made, Friday afternoon, the bloke came back from the...
Friday afternoon?
You know, he couldn't be bothered going back for the other piston and rod. And he built it.
1:30 in the taxi queue on a Saturday morning. Never mind Friday afternoon. But Ian, is that not the fact that that car was being used by the owner, who didn't think it was quite right, with only 11 of the 12 cylinders? Is that not a tribute to the excellence of Jaguar engineering and that V12, one of the greatest engines ever made?
Well, it had 12 cylinders, so it can just about cope with one missing. But having said that, I've got to say that I'm building a special at the moment, and I'm sorry to say I'm putting a V12 Jaguar engine in it, so they can't all be that bad. There were good parts there. They were beautifully designed. They were good cars. I think we're focusing too much on the people that put them together.
Well, I don't know, because I think it's important. And I think sometimes the experience of owning some of these cars, which often get trotted out when there's ever a list of great cars, those of us that have actually owned them think, the only reason that when you drive one now, it seems like a great car is because, like with my GTV6, all of the problems, the gear linkage on that bloody car, I mean, all of the problems that were there in the car have been subsequently sorted by enthusiasts through racing, through restoration. People have found new modern parts. And so maybe a car like the Series 3 Jag XJ6, if you're running one now, there are all kinds of mods that you would have done to the car to actually make it the car that they wanted it to be. Anyway, let's talk about a car which was always built right. It was built so right that if you go now to West Africa, you'll see examples rolling down the highway in Morocco or Mali or the Gambia or Senegal with no glass in them, no headlights, the bonnet tied on with rope. I've been in this very vehicle, a petite taxi, held it at the side of the road. These Mercedes 123s have been to the moon and back. They have got mileage on them on some of the worst roads in the world that you can imagine, and yet they are still holding together and they are still transporting people. And sometimes, well, the one that I got in already had seven people in it from A to B. Thank God the journey was only a couple of miles. Guy, the Mercedes 123, not a very glamorous car, but surely one of the greatest cars ever made.
Has to be. Contemporary road tests, I was reading the Motorsport road test, called it the best Mercedes mass-produced car yet in 1977. And Motorsport didn't praise cars. They didn't do it. They would pick holes, especially in foreign cars. Sorry to the late Mr. Boddy and Jenks, etc., but Motorsport liked to fly the flag, but they looked at this car and were astonished. I mean, Jenks had his Porsche because his 356 was the ultimate small sports car of the day, as we've discussed before on a previous Speed Shop. But the W123 was right, absolutely spot on out of the box, and with build quality that Jaguar were dreaming of.
I was looking at one yesterday. I went round to see a friend who has both an E28 BMW and a Mercedes W123 in restoration. The E28 is stripped down to a body shell. You can see that it was a well-made car. The constituent parts that it was put together with, you know, 30 years on, 35 years on, still in great shape. The car's going to be a relatively easy restoration. But he was... This is a guy who restores cars for a living, all kinds of cars, British cars, American cars. He was praising this 123 to the heavens, because when it came to restoration, the car just came apart. Like he said, it was like it rolled out of the factory last week. And he said he rarely reuses. He restores, like yourself, Ian, to a very high standard. He very rarely reuses parts. And one thing that's amazed him as a professional car restorer is how much of this 36-year-old BMW he's been able to, Mercedes rather, he's been able to reuse.
I think that's I've got to say, as an ex-BMW service manager, yeah, I've got to stand up and say the Mercedes was head and shoulders above the BMW. The BMW was the driver's car. The Mercedes was just, it would do everything. It wasn't quite as sporty in its how people thought of it, but beautifully put together. And you're quite right, they'll go forever and a day. We get them in here and they just keep going and going and going and going. And the only time we have a problem is if somebody who doesn't know what they're doing has played about with it, and then it can be problematic. But apart from that, if they just service correctly, just keep going and never stop.
Not an affordable car to buy at the time, Guy, and a lot of people would have looked at it, particularly the sort of person that buys their car by the square yard, and thought, well, this is a relatively small car. Why is it costing me so much? But people who understood quality knew that this was a very special car, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. It's an old, I can't remember who coined the phrase, but the quality is remembered long after the price is forgotten. And the Mercedes just carried on delivering. You felt special every time you got into it, whereas the headlining would probably descend onto your head in your Jaguar after 18 months. And the BMW, you may find yourself not being Jochen Rindt or Derek Bell and sticking it through a wall because it was, you're not as good as it was. Whereas the Mercedes just delivered.
When I had my E28 525E, the Etta, a friend of mine said, you like these old German cars, and told me where there was a 123 in Glossop in the hills just south of Manchester. And I went to collect the car. I phoned the guy. This is pre-eBay and buying things online. I went down to collect the car, which had sat for 14 years. and I swear to God, we squirted some Easy Start in, down the carburetor, made sure the battery was charged, took the plugs out, cleaned them, put them back in, started it up, pumped up the tyres, and drove it back to Manchester. What a car.
Yeah, that's those stories are just common. There's lots of people that, oh, it's been in my garage for years, can you just come and look at it? You put a battery on it, put some new fuel in it, crank it over, and it fires. You bring it back and you go through it, and before you know where you are, you've got a car on the road again that's safe and solid and maybe a little bit frilly around the edges, but nothing that... They were good quality steel, but that's the way they were.
The peripherals were good as well, weren't they? The ones that I've been in that are very high mileage. The carpets, the seats, the steering wheel, the gear lever. It's like every single thing was made with the full intention that this car should be able to turn maybe not a million miles, but at least a million kilometres.
Absolutely right. It's the number of old Jaguar dashboards with cracked plastic Lucas switches in, and as I say, headlining that's come down, or the door trim that's come off. The BMWs, that they just seem to be a little more fragile. The seat bolsters will have gone when they've got to 120,000 miles.
Oh, and the carpets are worn out.
Yeah, and the carpets, the where your heels rub at the bottom, the rubber mat will have gone through. But the Mercedes, give it a vac and a polish, it's presentable.
Yeah, but it's not good business, is it? You build a car for the first owner. And if the impression from the first owner on the BMW was better, what's the point in impressing somebody 10, 15 years down the road? If the sort of Naga hide or thick vinyl, everyone always thinks that's leather in a Mercedes. It's not leather. But there you go. MB Tex. Yeah, that's the MB Tex seats. Never, ever, ever wear out. Ever. When the human race is gone, there'll still be rear seats from Mercedes 123s in perfect condition because they never wear out. But is this that car? Is this the car, the 123 series, the one that convinces Mercedes to stop making cars like this because it doesn't make business sense?
I think you're right. I think, yes, it didn't make business sense. But having said that, it always... A few years down the line and the cars are still looking good, it then gives an aspiration to the person that's buying that. Well, if they're this good now, I want to up my game and up my game and up my game and buy a better and better Mercedes. So, yes, they are a good car. I don't think they'll ever be built quite as good as that.
Ever. No. There's no point. There's no point impressing people 20 years after the thing was made. You impress people in the showroom when they're putting the money down. OK, gentlemen, let's call it. Guy, you came up with this category of... I forgot what the category was again. You'll have to remind me. Too much information.
Aspirational bank manager's motor of 1978 to 1982. That era of cars. And I'm going to... I'm going to have a tricky one on this because in the day, I still think the Middle Englander bank manager would have bought a Jag.
Yeah.
That was his aspiration. Today, it's got to be Jag 3, BMW 2, Merc 1.
Yeah.
Simply because of the proposition of what you get for your money with a W123 right now.
Right, well, Ian's definitely not going to call it in that order, but if you could call it 3-2-1, Ian, Miss World style in ascending order, the Jaguar, the Mercedes.
Jaguar's got to be number
three. He can't get the words out quick enough to diss the British car, the Coventry-built product, you terrible turncoat.
Jaguar's got to be number three. The Mercedes and the BMW, it'd be a tough call. If you're a driver, go for the BMW. If you're wanting solidity, go for a Mercedes. In today's market, the Mercedes is the one that you're getting good value for money when you buy a Mercedes. You're going to have to do some work to a BM. Unless it's been a minter and cosseted all its life, you're going to have to put some work into a BM of the equivalent Mercedes to get the same car. And I would say that the Mercedes is the one to go for. So I'll have to agree with Guy for value, Mercedes, BMW, Jaguar.
Well, I'm going to put the jagging third, which causes me pain. I think it was a great looking motor car, one of the greatest, engine. I'm a jag man. I, you know, the whole thing. It started in Lancashire. I am a proud Lancastrian. I find myself here on the wrong side of the hill, but amongst friends, I hope. And I'm going to have to put the jag in third. The Mercedes. I told the tale, I told the anecdote about buying one that had sat for over a decade, unloved. We just pumped up the tyres, put fuel in it, and the thing just ran. It breezed through an MOT test. But it wasn't an exciting car to own and drive. It was a beautifully made car, very reliable car, durable car. It looked good-ish, not as good as the BMW, but it was just unengaging to drive, whereas all three BMW E28s that I owned, the 528, the 525, and the 520i Lux, which I like best out of all three, they were driver's cars, like you said, Ian. They looked great, interior and exterior. I liked the dimensions of the car. I liked everything about that car. And they were also, all three of them were great cars to drive. They still are. You still drive one of those, and it feels remarkably modern, as long as you get the right one. But it's not up to me, or to Ian, or to Guy. It's up to you. Go to our Facebook page, Steve Speed Shop, and tell us which you think was the greatest of these three, the Mercedes-Benz W123 series, the BMW E28, or the Series 3 Jaguar XJ6. Well, that's it from Speed Shop for another week. Don't forget to tell your friends about the podcast, which appears about 24 hours after the show. And join us back here next week, same time on Fab Radio International.